Welcome to Move the Needle. This show is designed to inform, educate, motivate, and provide perspective on all things related to pharmacy provided immunization services. Let's start moving the needle. Welcome to another episode of Move the Needle. As this show says, we are designed to inform, educate, motivate, and provide perspective on all things related to pharmacy provided immunization services. Today we have Ed and John as usual, and also special guest Michael Hoag. We're going to focus more on vaccine hesitancy and boosters like we kind of talked about in episode 2. So Ed and John, could you define vaccine hesitancy and the reasons for it, such as is this the same as seasonal flu as for COVID, or have you seen different things in the past and now?
We've heard a lot about vaccine hesitancy actually since the vaccines became available, and looking forward to hearing our guest, Dr. Hoag's perspective on this. But, you know, with regard to COVID, I think vaccine hesitancy is a little bit different than the typical vaccine hesitancy that we see with other vaccines, such as the seasonal flu. And I know we're going to be talking about that too, because, you know, we don't want to sleep on the seasonal flu because it's an important consideration as well. But the other thing I think is important to differentiate is that there really is a difference between vaccine hesitancy and the anti-vaxxer type movement. I think the vaccine hesitancy related to COVID has a lot to do with people's genuine concerns about the safety of the vaccine. But I'll let Dr. Hoag develop that thought a little bit further. But Ed, you may want to talk a little bit about the fact that vaccines are really running pretty strong in pharmacies these days.
Well, John, thank you for that. Quick update. Immunizations remain strong in pharmacies. And what we're seeing is 80% of immunizations provided to patients, eligible patients, are provided in pharmacy. Of course, there's just an enormous amount of COVID vaccine that accounts for that percentage. I think it's north of 70% of all COVID vaccines provided today are done in pharmacies, and pharmacies are standing ready to vaccinate the younger children that we just got some approval there, the 5 to 11-year-olds. So we're really excited about that as well. So despite hesitancy and all the commotion with mandates and that we're going to get into today, immunizations are a mainstay, and pharmacy has been and continues to be recognized as probably the number one provider of immunization services. We don't want to get too bogged down on just talking COVID, because this is the heart of the flu season. Flu season is in full swing in pharmacy, and we are encouraging every patient that comes to the pharmacy, of course, to get a flu shot, their annual flu shot. I know I've gotten mine. I've been very diligent this year and last year, more so than ever before, to make sure that I'm protected not only from flu, but from COVID. John, we talked earlier today about the vaccine that's delivered to pharmacies, and we talked a little bit about the 5 to 11-year-old. We've always talked about staying out of the space that we share with pediatricians, and today pharmacies are looking to be the primary provider of vaccine to 5 to 11-year-olds. And I will add that I live in Chicago. Today became a school holiday. They close all the schools in the city of Chicago to allow parents the opportunity to take their children to the pharmacy and to the doctor to get immunized. So all the 5 and 11-year-olds have the day off from school to get immunized today. So maybe just talk a little bit about that shared space and the opportunity for collaboration between pharmacy and the pediatricians.
Yeah, I'm really glad you mentioned that. There have been a number of important things going on over the last couple of weeks. And I think, you know, certainly right now at the top of the list has been the approval of the pediatric vaccine. It's actually being delivered to pharmacies and pediatricians' offices as we speak. And, you know, I think we're probably going to see an initial surge of vaccination from highly motivated families and parents. But I think there's still a little bit of reservation out there. And I think it's an opportunity for pharmacists and pediatricians to work together. As you mentioned, there have been some turf battles in the past with pharmacists and pediatricians, pediatricians being concerned about regular well child visits going by the wayside if people come to the pharmacy for their vaccines. But in this case, I really think because of the demand, the pediatricians are going to be overwhelmed and they're really going to need some help. So I think this is a huge opportunity for pharmacists to make a lot of friends in the pediatric medical community. So, you know, there's enough vaccinations that need to be administered to go around for everybody. And I think it's going to take a lot of collaboration between pediatricians and pharmacists to really make this work.
We've heard a lot about boosters, and for a while now, boosters have outpaced those folks getting their first shot. And I know there's an enormous amount of uptake with all of the mandates that are coming down and around by different organizations. What have you been hearing about the boosters? And I know from a chain perspective, and I have an extensive background there, boosters have been and are and continue to be very strong. Do you see the same thing in the independent community space?
Yeah, I think boosters are really going strong. I think most people that elected to get the primary series, I think there's been minimal resistance regarding getting the additional shot, the booster. And I think that's certainly true in the independent sector. I think if you were to ask the administration, they would tell you that boosters are important, but we've still got a lot of people that are unvaccinated, and there's still some opportunity there to do whatever is required to get these folks to get their vaccinations. I know we've had a couple of recent authorizations, directives by the White House. One is OSHA has come out requiring employers that have over 100 employees mandated that they get vaccinated or test weekly. The other thing is the CMS announced this week the details of a program that is going to require healthcare workers at facilities participating in the Medicare and Medicaid program to be fully vaccinated. That's hitting on a lot of folks that may be unvaccinated to date. So again, I don't know how folks feel about mandates. I think that may be an opportunity to ask Dr. Hoag what he thinks, and I'd like to get his opinion on the vaccine hesitancy issue as well. So Dr. Hoag, I'm going to turn things over to hear from you.
Well, John, thanks. I really appreciate being on with you and Ed. An honor and a privilege to get to speak with your listeners today. I'm going to take a little bit of a non-traditional approach and maybe interject some different thinking on this issue of mandates and hesitancy and so forth, because I kind of see this from a pretty pragmatic way. I think what we're seeing happen right now, John, is a lot of very emotional reaction to these mandates. And I think we as Americans are pretty proud of the freedoms that we have. And whenever anyone tells us we have to do something, regardless of what it is, we don't like to do it. I mean, I remember back when the seatbelt laws in the United States were passed in the early 80s, I can remember my father being pretty upset that somebody was telling him that he had to wear a seatbelt. And so it was a pretty difficult thing. So mandates, I mean, I think it's just fair that we acknowledge, we'd be foolish not to just frankly acknowledge that this is a deeply emotional discussion when it comes to mandates. So I'm not taking a position for or against them. I'm just simply acknowledging that they're an emotional thing. And it's important for pharmacists to understand that as healthcare providers, because what your patients are bringing to the table when they come into the pharmacy and they're, you know, they're hesitant or resistant, there is an emotional component to that. Beyond just concerns that they might have. And we just need to be prepared to understand that. I would just say, you know, that there's two groups of people that we need to think about here as it relates to mandates. First of all, I want to talk about healthcare professionals themselves and mandates that healthcare workers be vaccinated. You know, I think that as a consumer, as a patient, all of us need to, first of all, think about ourselves as a consumer and as a patient. And when we walk into a doctor's office, or we go into a hospital, or we go into a pharmacy, we expect that we're going to receive the highest level of care, and the care that we receive is going to be provided in the safest environment possible. No one goes into a hospital anticipating that they're going to get a hospital acquired infection, do they? I mean, I don't think so.
I don't think so. I think you're right there.
Yeah. So if a consumer has the expectation that they're going to be able to have their problem addressed and not catch some other infection, that means that there is a societal expectation on healthcare workers that we have to hold ourselves to perhaps a little higher standard, and we have to do everything we can to prevent disease and prevent infection so that we don't become the vectors of infection. So as it relates to vaccine mandates in healthcare, you know, we've had vaccine mandates in healthcare for a really long time. We've required pertussis immunization, for example, in hospitals and health systems and pharmacies and doctor's offices for 2 decades. We've required flu shots. Is there not a time we haven't? So this is not new. The idea of healthcare workers getting a COVID vaccine is not new. But the concept that the vaccine was mandated initially under EUA by a lot, I think, elicited an emotional response. And that emotion, I think, in some cases has overridden people's logic about why a mandate might be necessary in a healthcare setting. Now, when we start talking about what action OSHA just took with employers, I think at that point is where it gets really a lot more political. And I'm not going to opine on whether I think there ought to be mandates for non-healthcare workers. I think mandates for healthcare workers make sense. They work. They help keep consumers safe. And that's our first job as a pharmacist. When we move beyond that, I think it becomes a much more political issue. And I'm not sure, you know, that maybe they're appropriate, maybe they're not. I'm sure we could polarize your audience if I took a position one way or the other on this, but I'll try not to do that.
That's fair. And again, the point that you just made about vaccine mandates have really been in place with other vaccines for healthcare workers for a long time. So this is really, like you said, nothing new.
Michael, you have also said that there is a rigorous scientific process in place, and scientific process that you, of all people sitting on the ACIP as the only pharmacist, as a pharmacist representative, you're in a unique place to be able to know, first off, and then speak to the rigorous scientific process. And you also have shared with John and I that the FDA and the CDC work group, those processes have been in place for a while, and they were formed under one president and they remain in place under a second president.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's important for your listeners to understand. I mean, there is a very rigorous scientific process for these vaccines for COVID. In fact, there's rigorous scientific processes for the use of all vaccines. Just this week, the ACIP actually approved recommendations for the use of a brand new smallpox vaccine during emergency situations, and a new Ebola virus vaccine in emergency situations. Neither of those things made the news because we don't have an Ebola outbreak or a smallpox outbreak going on, but yet we followed a very detailed scientific procedure. And I think it's important for your listeners to know that the FDA has an advisory committee that reviews, it's called the Vaccines and Biologics Advisory Committee, or VRBPAC. And VRBPAC is made up of individuals who are infectious disease experts and who specialize in vaccinology and immunology. And these are individuals who do not accept money from the pharmaceutical industry. They don't have funding from the pharmaceutical industry. And they look at the evidence. They look at the science. And they're required to make recommendations to the FDA on whether or not a product should be approved or not approved under whether it's emergency use authorization or full biologics application approval. And they make those recommendations to the FDA. And by the same token, at the CDC, that's the role of the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. The voting members of the ACIP are not allowed to accept money from the pharmaceutical industry. They are required to review the scientific evidence. There's a variety of work groups that give advice to the ACIP on their work. With the COVID vaccine work group, I've sat on that work group since it was formed back in April of 2020. And I can tell you that 45 individuals on that group, none of us accept money from the pharmaceutical industry. We look at the science. We review every bit of evidence. It's thousands of pages worth of documents at this point and hours worth of discussion and very rigorous discussion about every detail of the evidence, the safety evidence, the efficacy evidence. And we don't take our jobs lightly. We take it very seriously. So I think that we are confident. I know I'm confident that the recommendations that have come out on the use of these vaccines from Pfizer, BioNTech, from Moderna, and from J&J I feel very confident that they are the right recommendations, that these vaccines are safe. There are risks for some individuals based upon their medical and medication history, and those things are outlined in the approval processes. It's okay to be concerned and worried because it is something relatively new. But, you know, we've given 400 million doses now of these vaccines just in the United States alone, and about 6.3 billion doses of COVID vaccines around the world. And this has largely happened. It's globally the safest and largest vaccination campaign that's ever been implemented in the world's history. And so there should be some confidence here that these processes are great and they actually do work. And not always does the work group agree with the politicians. We just call it like it is. I mean, both administrations have had this process in place. The Trump administration put this process in place for the COVID vaccines. The Biden administration has kept the same process in place. And the process is essentially the exact same process that's been in place for approval of every vaccine that we currently have on the market. So I have a high degree of confidence, and I hope your listeners will have a high degree of confidence that the scientific rigor behind this is really, really solid.
Great point. I mean, just there's so much been made of vaccine hesitancy, and it's certainly very real. Michael, how much do you think, and again, there's much been talked about regarding burnout among healthcare professionals, physicians, nurses, pharmacists. How much do you think the vaccine hesitancy issue is contributing to burnout?
Well, it's contributing very significantly, particularly in the hospital and health system setting, because had we had less hesitancy and quicker uptake of the vaccine, we would have not had the most recent surge of the Delta variant. Had the vaccine been accepted by the American consumers and had people not been hesitant to take the vaccine, when it first became available in the first quarter of 2021, what we've seen happen in the last 3 months wouldn't have happened. And so, you know, healthcare workers pulled every ounce of everything they had in their fiber of their body to get through January, February, and March of 2021, and were exhausted and were ready for a rest as the trough hit at that time. And we saw cases pretty much dissipate. And I think a lot of pharmacists and nurses, respiratory therapists in particular, and physicians were just exasperated when the Delta variant started to cause a major surge. And we realized that 90%+ of the people we were seeing in the hospital were unvaccinated. It's demoralizing to you as a healthcare professional because you've given everything you've had to take care of people. There's a way to prevent these infections and people are not accepting it. It's demoralizing. And as a result, we're seeing people leave the health professions as a career choice. And it's very sad. I mean, I think many of the people who are walking out on nursing right now and walking out on medicine and walking out on pharmacy are probably going to do that on a temporary basis. They'll get their air back in their lungs and their wings back, and hopefully they'll come back and practice their professions. But they're exhausted, and the hesitancy's definitely had an impact on that, John.
So, Michael, to that point, turning to the community practice environment, maybe you can just touch a bit on the impact of technicians being able to provide COVID vaccines and assist, and now they're providing flu vaccine. We're looking to, and we're hoping that now that we have this technician army that can assist with immunization practices, that some of this will have some stickiness across the states and stay with us long term.
Let me just say this. Thank God for pharmacy technicians. Holy moly. They have been just absolutely a lifesaver for pharmacists. It's just been amazing to me to see technicians step into the gap and be willing to be trained and to take on these advanced roles. I mean, we've known for years, Ed, you know, I'm a former independent pharmacy owner myself and have also, you know, here while I'm the dean of a school of pharmacy, my community pharmacy ties are awfully deep. And we owned pharmacy until just recently here at the school. So I know a lot about community pharmacy practice, and we couldn't have done it without technicians. They've made a major inroad. we do need, as pharmacists, we need to work closely with our state pharmacy associations to get permanent laws passed so that when the PrEP Act eventually expires, which it will at some point in the future, that in each and every state, we still have these wonderful helpmates beside us helping to give these vaccinations. It's very important that technicians retain the authorities after the PrEP Act expires to administer vaccines. And so I think pharmacists, if one message for you is let's partner up with our state pharmacy associations and really work hard to get legislation passed at the state level if it hasn't happened already in your state, and let's get these technicians authorized for the long haul.
I'm going to double down on that, support your state pharmacy associations. And I think that every State Pharmacy Association and pharmacy group, John, NCPA included, has done a yeoman's job supporting the individual pharmacist and their practice ability by just providing such an enormous amount of guidance and information to help build this whole process, not only for chains, but for independent community owners and for the individual pharmacists. I can't emphasize that enough, the need to continue to support state pharmacy associations.
I think we need, as a profession, independence and chains. We really need to leverage the fact that pharmacists have really stepped up, you know, beginning with the onset of the pandemic, and now we're doing boosters and we're on the cusp of providing pediatric vaccines. There's been a lot of good that has happened as a result of what pharmacists have been able to do and what they've been able to contribute to the pandemic effort. So hopefully we can leverage that. It's certainly been an opportunity to showcase pharmacists, to showcase technicians, and we certainly don't want to take a step back. So again, NCPA is working very closely with state pharmacy associations to make sure that we don't take that step back and we're able to carry forward what we've been authorized to do as a result of the PrEP Act.
Hey, gentlemen, I got to throw in one more quick topic before we have to wrap up. And I want to get some guidance and some thoughts about co-administration of vaccines and how are pharmacists thinking about this? Are they encouraged to do this? I know that we've always done flu and pneumo together. Now we've got guidance that you can do flu and COVID. Some thoughts there, Michael, John?
You know, I don't know if pharmacists are aware of this, but within the last couple of weeks, ACIP has approved new recommendations for the use of pneumococcal vaccines. We've got new conjugate vaccines on the market, and there's a renewed and expanded group of people who need to receive pneumococcal vaccine. We're very conscientious right now about respiratory illness. We're all worried about respiratory illness, and we need to, you know, comprehensively prevent respiratory illnesses in our patients right now, especially during the pandemic. So co-administration of inactivated vaccines is absolutely recommended and is supported by the CDC. The inactivated vaccines do not seem to have any interference with antibody titers. And so, you know, we'd encourage you as you're looking at your patient population that you're vaccinating, especially your older patient population that you're vaccinating against COVID, now's the time to be screening them for their need for flu vaccine and pneumococcal vaccine, and frankly, giving them all three. And then the other thing that I'd mention is that just this week, ACIP also made a new recommendation that all adults 19 to 59 years of age need to receive a hepatitis B immunization series. Yeah. And that's another vaccine that can be given together with the COVID vaccine and with the flu vaccine. So, you know, there's a lot of opportunity out there for pharmacists right now. And, you know, the key is prioritizing. I know if you're limited on your resources, and John, you might comment about this as well, but if you're limited on the resources you have and you have to say, okay, well, I don't have time to do a comprehensive immunization right now, you know, think about, you know, get them their flu and COVID shot today and make an appointment with them to come back and get their pneumococcal and hepatitis B vaccine or Tdap update and come back at another time and get those. Capitalize on the opportunity you've got with the patient in your pharmacy at that time and get them back.
Michael, you're a great cheerleader for co-administration. I'm not sure I've got a whole lot to add to that other than, you know, like you just said, you've got somebody coming in for a COVID vaccine or a booster shot. You've got a captive audience there. There's a requirement to wait to make sure you're not going to experience a reaction. So that 15 to 30 minute waiting period is an opportunity to assess the patient's immunization record, you know, find out where the gaps are, and to really, you know, take advantage of co-administration. I think one final point is there's been a little bit of confusion about co-administration, and certainly the CDC has authorized that. I wish they had maybe made a stronger statement about it and made it completely clear and really came out and maybe had a stronger voice about, you know, what an opportunity that is to close some gaps.
Yeah, I think the statement could be a little bit stronger, but I will say that sitting on those committees, they absolutely do support co-administration, and I think pharmacists should absolutely use their professional judgment to help make sure people are fully vaccinated.
Well, gentlemen, on that point, I think our conversation covered an enormous amount of territory today. Michael, I can't thank you enough for joining us. Welcome you back anytime.
Really appreciate you having me. Thank you.
Well, thank you. And John, as always, it's a pleasure to be with you and share this time with our audience.
Yeah, enjoy being with you, Ed and Michael. Thanks again for joining us. It's great to have you on the program.